Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pregnant women are faced with a mountain of do's and don'ts. Recommendations on food, drink, exercise, vitamins, smoking, screenings, even cat litter and hot tubs. The advice comes from all directions. My guest today got pregnant and decided to track down the advice that was good and real, and where there might be a debate. This hour On Point, double-checking the do's and don'ts of pregnancy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation's always on. Did you get advice from all over when you found out there was a bun in the oven? What did you follow? What did you question, wonder about? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will talk about NASA's spacecraft launch tonight to investigate the mysteries of moon dust. But first, joining me from New Haven, Connecticut, is economist and pregnancy advice skeptic Emily Oster, associate professor of economics at the University of Chicago and author of the new book, Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. Emily Oster, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Also with us from Sacramento, California, is Dr. Jean Connery, president of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the nation's largest OBGYN group. Dr. Connery, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so very much, Tom. It's good to be here.
So here's a whole book coming at you from an economist, Dr. Connery, young economist who was just pregnant herself, who's ready to go back and look at all the evidence and maybe reach some of her own conclusions. We're going to hear all about that from Emily in just a moment. But as a doctor who's right in the middle of this, do you welcome that kind of questioning and poking and prodding at traditional advice? Does it worry you?
You know, I welcome any attempt to explain pregnancy and pregnancy better to all of our patients. Pregnancy is that wonderful time where we truly are asked to communicate clearly and to provide care for both a mom and an infant, a fetus, through 9 months. I liken it to a long-term track event or a cross-country meet where you've got to have a team and go forward.
And Emily, here you are, economist trained to look at all the research and make your own conclusions. You get pregnant and you're poked and prodded and and infantilized in a way, you say, Emily. You felt like people were just shoving advice at you, what, in a way that wasn't entirely respectful or maybe even from your economist view, grounded.
Yeah, so I think there were sort of two issues. I think for many women, of course, there's advice. One thing is advice from your doctor. I think that's very welcome. There's, of course, advice from all kinds of people who just see you on the street and want to tell you different things. Right. But I think that, you know, even in the – I think one of the things that I struggled with was even when advice was given, it often disagreed. So, you know, my doctor would disagree with my friend's doctor and, you know, the book would disagree with, you know, with what my – with what my doctor said or with other books. And so I think a lot of the push here was for me in my job when I would encounter disagreement like that, I would say, okay, let's like go to the source, let's go to the data. And my instinct was to do that here as well. And so ultimately, if you read the book, I think it kind of comes at this in a little bit of a different way than a doctor would, sort of just saying, let's just look at the data and then let's use that to try to structure some decisions, you know, kind of on your own in some sense. So but then, of course, to go back to your doctor and talk about this.
Okay, you're putting the caveat right on there.
No, of course. I mean, I think that's actually a very important caveat is that, you know, really the idea here, like with any pregnancy book, is that you will go read it and then you will come back more informed and better able to have a productive conversation with your doctor. I mean, the book's not going to deliver your baby for you. No one would suggest that.
but a lot of people feel it come on in a big hurry. You said pregnancy medical care seemed to be one long list of rules.
And so your book, sort of going full length with this great big list of notes and research findings that you poured through at the back, you write here, this book is, it's the suggestion that maybe it's okay to have a glass of wine. We'll look at that. And more important, the data on why or why not, I guess. It's the numbers on risk of miscarriage by week, data on which fish to eat to make your kid smart and which to avoid because it can make your kid dumb, and right on down. What is the range of things you've looked at here, Emily, in your sort of double checking of pregnancy advice?
Yeah, so I tried to look at kind of all of the things that at least came up for me or my friends in sort of standard kind of low risk pregnancy. So certainly the book goes through, kind of what to eat, what kind of activities to do. It goes through things about prenatal testing, which is something I think many women, struggle with. It goes through issues around the birth, epidurals, what other kinds of interventions might there be. We stop at the delivery room, so no breastfeeding. I certainly don't – there's a little bit on high-risk pregnancy, but certainly, this book is kind of more about sort of if everything is, blessedly going normally, kind of how do I think about some of these decisions which I'm really going to have to make. And my sister-in-law complains there's not a lot about twins. She just had twins, but there's not a lot about twins.
So you've got a lot in here on labor induction and exercise and weight and epidural or not. And as you say, that prenatal screening, who ought to have it, who shouldn't. Let's just go to one big one right away and get Dr. Connery in here on it as well. I mean, everybody hears this very early on, the issue of alcohol consumption comes up, and you can hear a whole range of things on that, but most of them tend toward the no, don't do it. You jumped in on that, Emily, and what did you find?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's very clear that excess drinking during pregnancy is bad. I think everyone agrees on that. I think when you turn to light drinking, there's more disagreement. I think many obstetricians like mine will tell you, a few drinks a week is fine. I wanted to understand better the source of that disagreement. And I think for many women, especially when faced with conflicting advice, you kind of – there's the impetus to go to the source and understand. And I think when you look at the data, you see a variety of, pretty large, well-designed studies which show that the children of women who drink in moderation – I think it's very important to be clear that that means, no more than a couple drinks a week in the first trimester, no more than a drink a day in later trimesters, that the children of women who drink at those levels – don't show any additional complications relative to women who abstain. And so I suggest that many women may look at that and think, perhaps it's okay to have the occasional glass of wine. But that really this is something where we should be encouraging people to look at the data and think about this decision.
All right, Dr. Connery, women who are or may one day be pregnant are going to be listening closely here. I'm listening, reading here from the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. And they don't like this advice at all. They put out a release saying they're outraged by Emily Oster's deeply flawed and harmful advice about alcohol and pregnancy, saying light drinking during pregnancy cannot be considered risk-free just because some studies found it not to be a risk factor in one specific area of development. They say alcohol is a neurotoxin, developing babies can't process any amount of alcohol, and alcohol is more harmful, this group writes, to a developing baby than heroin or cocaine. So what do you say, Dr. Connery?
Agree completely. So let me put it in perspective. We know that alcohol consumption is the leading known cause of mental retardation in the United States. It is associated with lifelong learning disabilities, with birth defects, neurologic behavioral impairments. Alcohol crosses the placenta, and it is clearly avoidable. There is no known benefit of alcohol during pregnancy. So that puts it in perspective. We've got alcohol spectrum disorder. Clearly, we all realize that high intake of alcohol is associated with some of the more severe complications. But what we haven't been able to show is any level that is absolutely safe. Give you an example, University of Washington, where some of the largest long-term studies have been done, looking at, in fact, where fetal alcohol syndrome was first diagnosed and identified as a disorder, several decades ago. Mm-hmm. They've got longitudinal studies, so long-term studies of children with it, and they found that 1 in 7 was born to a mom who had low to moderate alcohol intake. What they said is they could not predict which child was going to develop fetal alcohol syndrome or some part of the spectrum. They could not predict which mother was going to give birth to a child with fetal alcohol syndrome or some aspect of the spectrum. So if we cannot predict which amount or which one is going to be a risk, then we've got 9 months, and we recommend abstinence. We say you're better off not consuming any. We're very aware of the variety of results. We can say, in fact, Dr. Oster does a great job talking about how we can't do some of the cleanest research during pregnancy because of the ethics. We can't do those kind of studies. But what we can look at are a host of different studies. And overwhelmingly, the conclusions of every study are that we need to err on the side of caution. And the side of caution says that we have not been able to identify any amount of alcohol that is absolutely safe in pregnancy.
Emily, Dr. Conry, stand by. I'll bring you back in here, but I want to get a response before the break. So there you go, Emily, the president of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and says, hey, economist Emily, where do you get off saying it's okay to have one or two a week in the first trimester and one maybe a day after that? I mean, how do you look at the same research and come up with different answers, Emily?
So I think, I think we all look at this research that I have, and I think one of the points Dr. Conry is making is, yes, we do not have large randomized controlled trials of this issue, and I think that's right. And I think some women will look at this and say, that's the only thing I would find compelling, and I think that that's fine. Now, there's a couple of points. One is this study you cite from the University of Washington. I think there's a bit of a point to make there, which is that's as far as I can tell, that's a letter to the editor and not a peer-reviewed study, that fact. And also the women there were drinking 1 to 8 drinks a week in the first trimester, and we don't know how much they're drinking at a time. So I think there's a little bit of a push here. We want to be making sure we're really looking at studies where we can really drill down to what people are doing. I also think it's worth saying that, there are many choices that we make during pregnancy where we know that it's not – that there's no benefit to the baby and there's some – there could be some risk, for example, driving in a car. And so I think to kind of – some of this discussion ends up sounding like it's possible to take no risk, where every time we're taking a little bit of some kind of risks for reasons because there are things that we might enjoy. And so I think that all I'm saying is we should subject the evidence and alcohol to the same kind of scrutiny that we would for other types of behaviors.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the standard do's and don'ts for women in pregnancy, asking what regular advice holds up and what may not, or at least what we learn in double-checking, testing. Emily Oster is with us. Her new book is Expecting Better. She's an economist who brought an economist's eye to drilling down on the research behind these recommendations. She doesn't agree with all of them. On the other hand, we've got Dr. Jean Conry here, president of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. You heard right there on alcohol consumption, a kind of a cross swords right off the bat. There will be things they will agree on. Smoking, absolutely out, says Emily. Dr. Conry, everybody, no smoking, please. But some things get a little more complicated. Emily, Dr. Conry, we had all kinds of response to this. I mean, Sylvie wrote to us on Facebook, when you're pregnant, advice comes all the time from everywhere on everything. Gail, talking about the advice she got, don't drink martinis, don't eat sushi, don't sit in the hot tub. We'll look at that. Dale said, people seem to love to tell pregnant women horror stories. It really bugged me and my wife when she was pregnant. So we try hard not to give unsolicited advice, but then doctors are supposed to. Elizabeth writes to us, everything in moderation. I drank some wine, ate deli meat, and steak cooked medium. I have a healthy baby boy. Dr. Conry, there's always that anecdotal thing. I mean, you have to give advice that works for lots of people. Then people may ignore it and still have a healthy baby, but I guess you've got a kind of public health requirement in mind. On the other hand, Emily, feeling empowered as an economist, used to looking at studies, goes in and does her own research. What about that approach, Dr. Conry?
So what I would say is that when we look at research, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is – we are devoted to the health of women with education research. We put together what we call committee opinions and guidelines for physicians. They are based on committees that are made up of epidemiologists, PhD researchers, physicians, specialists in the field that we're talking about. They analyze the research in depth, look at the pros and cons, look at the intricacies and the statistics behind it, and come up with the opinion based on all of that with a clinical understanding of the implications and the clinical understanding of the way a study was conducted, and then create guidelines. And those guidelines help us with a practice of medicine.
Emily,
I would just – I actually – I would just say I actually think the ACOG committee opinions are fantastic. And a lot of, you know, when I was pregnant, that was often the first place that I went. I think one of the things that I think many women struggle with is actually when you look at surveys of doctors, sometimes these like up-to-date and very thorough committee opinions haven't kind of always translated into practice. And so that's part of the sort of push for kind of women, let's like think about this for themselves, I think comes from this, the fact that there's some of this disagreement. And then you sort of feel like, well, if there's this disagreement, I kind of feel like I have to go to the source.
And you felt qualified to do that because you're an economist who deals with source material all the time. But here we've got a great big country. So you like your maybe a drink now and then, even when you're pregnant. But you hear Dr. Conry saying, no, don't go there. We don't know. You know, this National Organization of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome says Emily Oster is unqualified to write about alcohol use in pregnancy. How do you square all this, Emily? You know, we're looking for big messages to go out to the whole country here. You want to think about your pregnancy and feel qualified to do it. Should we just turn around and say Emily Oster says it's all right to have a drink? You know, we've got people listening here who may be pregnant right now and really care about this, really worried about it.
Look, I think that the message is that people should look at this, should look at this data. And
really?
You know, I think the message
is, I mean, are they qualified
not,
like you to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that people struggle with, and this is what I hear a lot for women, not so much on the alcohol, but in general, is that basically many women write to me and they're like, look, I'm trying to figure this out for myself and I really struggle to get through these studies and I can't always access them and I don't really understand what's a good study. And so a lot of what I'm trying to do in the book is kind of digest in all of these aspects of pregnancy is try to digest these studies using the fact that like that is what I was trained to do. I think there is, we should make an important distinction between kind of what we, between what the data says and maybe what like sort of national recommendations should be. I think there's a lot of issues that go into that which are different from sort of, which involve looking at the data but also involve thinking about sort of broader issues.
So you go all the way through that, and you got page after page of huge academic scholarly studies here that you've looked at. I don't know how many people could actually pull that off, but you've gone all the way through that, Emily, and then here comes Dr. Conry and says, that's wrong. We can't recommend the kind of alcohol consumption that you are recommending. How do you respond to that, Emily?
I mean, I think that what we can say is, look, I think we can have a discussion that is – we can have two kinds of discussion. One is we can say, look, I disagree with – I think that there are many studies that you haven't cited. And I think we could have that – I would be happy to have that discussion. I think we could also say, look, even with these studies, I think that without a randomized controlled trial, you know, the we should not be suggesting that this is safe. And I think, again, you know, that's a disagreement. And I think part of that disagreement extends into obstetricians. So I think that it isn't the case that every obstetrician says that you should have abstinence. There are many OBs. I've been on TV with some of them, and I have one of them as my OB, who will say, look, you know, a few drinks a week is fine. So obviously there's some room for disagreement here, even among people who are experts. And that's a place where I think, again, like when you face that kind of disagreement, there is many women have the kind of instinct to say, I just really need to go see what the data says for myself.
We've got a lot more points to look at here. We're going to dive in. Let me get a couple calls. Dr. Conry, I'll come to you with that. Kimberly in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Kimberly. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on the show. I just wanted to, you know, basically thank your guest for taking this on as a way. You know, I had wine during my pregnancy. I ate soft cheeses. I'm not like a crazy seeking risk kind of person, but I felt that those things were not terribly negative to what I was, you know, to me or to my developing fetus. And I also felt very sure about, you know, part of this is, I think, women trusting themselves in this process, and that, you know, experts about everything, and also what we think is safe, like what is our level and measure of safe, because if that's the case, then I shouldn't have eaten cantaloupe or spinach or all the other sort of foodborne illnesses that were killing people during that time. I mean, it's just, there's so many things that we can look at, and I think that I'm grateful for your guest for writing this book.
Kimberly, we've got it, and we'll pick that perspective up. Let me get one more call, and then we will. West Salem, Ohio. Kimberly, thank you. Kat, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have one comment. I would say I've had four children, and I would say drink as many drinks as you would give your infant after it's born.
And how many is that for you, Kat?
That would be none.
And was is that the rule of thumb you followed with your four pregnancies?
Absolutely.
And why is that? I mean, you hear Kimberly says, look, I feel comfortable with this. It's not a lot, a little wine. My baby, you know, is going to be okay. How do you respond, Kat? Kimberly went another way.
Well, I think every woman has to make their own decision, but I would put into my body what I would give my child after it's born or what I would give it as it's growing up.
Yeah.
And alcohol is not something I would give them.
Yeah, not the first thing to put in the baby bottle. I hear you. Dr. Conry, there's two women coming straight in right away with different views. And, you know, on the one hand, this notion don't have anything you wouldn't give an infant. That's interesting. On the other, the notion that's kind of there with both of them. Trust yourself on this. What about that idea of women trusting their own sense of what's safe, Dr. Conry?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Dr. Oster for pointing out that the ACOG guidelines are actually fabulous, well-researched.
Your group, and, American Congress of Obstetrics Gynecology, yeah.
Yeah, that they are well-researched, and we look at all of these. I think that we have to get away from focusing on an individual and what works for an individual, because correct. Statistically, if we look at any outcome, the probability of one person having something bad happen is low. You have to look at the recommendations across the entire population.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can look at the major causes of birth defects, of mental retardation, of learning disability being associated with alcohol, then you step back and say, if I haven't been able to show that anything is safe, why go there? And that's more than just trusting your body. It's more than just saying, you know, I feel fine taking this. I don't think there's going to be a problem.
I have a feeling we're not going to come to an agreement on that, but we see where the two of you stand on it, and listeners can hear it just as plain as day. Let's go to another. Caffeine. Emily, you like your caffeine. You like a couple of cups of coffee a day. What did you find in the research on that front?
Yeah, I do. So I do like a couple of cups of coffee a day. So, you know, I think in caffeine, actually, there's actually a tremendous amount of disagreement. So, you know, some books will say none. You know, most doctors will say two cups or a little more a day. You know, some people will say four. Some books will say six, you know. And so when I looked at caffeine, there's actually this sort of – it's quite hard to figure out the impacts of caffeine on miscarriage, which is like the most significant mm-hmm. concern. Because there's a confounding factor of nausea. So basically, nausea is a good sign about a healthy pregnancy, but it also causes women to avoid caffeine. So it's very hard to tease out the impacts of caffeine on miscarriage, or really, are these really just the impacts of nausea or lack of nausea on miscarriage? So when you look at the data, that's kind of a specter that goes over all of
you mean
these
because studies.
Because
you can't study, because women just tend to steer away from it because of the nausea, so you can't
yeah.
do a general good study. So
exactly.
how
so
do you what conclusion did you come to, Emily, about what's safe?
So despite that, I think what you see is there's a lot of evidence that basically all of the evidence suggests that having up to two cups a day is okay. So certainly women who tell me, like, I had a half a bar of chocolate and is that the end of the world? Like, no, that's okay. So, you know, up to two cups a day, 200 milligrams, I think is fine. When you look at sort of 3 to 4 cups a day, I argue that much of the evidence, although not all certainly, suggests that that's okay. As you start to get into more than 4 cups a day, which is, of course, quite a lot of coffee, there is, I think, more evidence that maybe it's linked to miscarriage. And so I think staying sort of out of that very high range is probably something many women will choose to do.
So, Dr. Conry, there's our visiting economist looking deeply into the research of your field. Two cups of coffee, fine, she says. What do you say? What's the American Congress say?
American Congress clearly said in 2010 that 200 milligrams of caffeine a day was probably safe. And we've had that statement out there. We make that very clear to our patients. We have done – actually, I'm part of the medical group that did the research on miscarriages and caffeine. So we look at that. And in the very well-done studies, it looks about 200 milligrams of caffeine a day is safe.
So
are people conservative when yeah. they do that? Certainly. There are some patients who've had 3 miscarriages, and for them they say, you know, I'm not going to take anything. We understand how individuals will make the decision, but as a set of guidelines and recommendations, we say probably up to 200 milligrams is safe.
And I guess it depends what you're drinking, where you hit that 200 milligrams, Emily. One cup of
exactly.
brewed Starbucks is like, Emily, you said 160, 170 right there. So
yeah.
maybe it's not two cups of that, but home brew, maybe it's fine. And off you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
We've got a lot more to look at here on the pregnancy front and the do's and don'ts that women hear. Emily Oster is testing some of those in her new book, Expecting Better. Dr. Jean Connery is here with the sort of medical view as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Susan is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I'm currently pregnant, and my take on it is pregnancy is only 9 months. It's very precious to me. Why not do everything I can to make sure that it's healthy? So I don't drink alcohol. I don't eat sushi. I don't eat cold cuts. I don't even drink coffee.
And you're just prepared to err on the side of caution. It's only 9 months, so why not be cautious, I guess?
Exactly, yes. To me, it's more important to make sure that my baby is healthy than to think, well, maybe I could have a drink or two here and there.
Yeah, that's a perspective that I know very well from a lot of women I know who have been pregnant. Emily, you've resisted that. You know, you haven't been prepared to go with it. Why not?
It's not that I resist people. I think actually what Susan says makes a tremendous amount of sense. I think all that I think is true is that we should let people make that choice. And they recognize that looking at the evidence, they may make it differently. I think the other thing is that a lot of the impetus for this book for me was not as much these like behavioral things, but some of these choices in pregnancy or around issues of birth, which really we have to make. Like in some sense, you have to choose whether or not to have an epidural. You okay. can't say, look, I'm just not going to have any coffee. Like there is some active choice you have to make there. Right. And that's a place where I think many women struggle to think about the right choice. And there's no way to just say, you know what, forget it. I'm just going to like say no. And I'm not going to worry about whether it's okay. I'm just going to say no. I think there you really have to make an active choice. And much of the stuff in the book, especially much of the stuff I spent my time on when I was pregnant was really about those choices.
Well, let's look at that one. Susan raises sushi and cold cuts. We'll come to those. But what about the epidural? This is the intravenous pain relief a lot of women start out thinking they won't get it, and then they ask for it anyway. Let's get the official recommendations first. Dr. Connery, what do you say about the epidural? Yes, no, risk factors or not?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate Susan on her pregnancy. I think it's the most exciting time and the most intimate time of a woman's
Amen.
Life. Sharing that with her obstetrician is priceless. Epidurals are wonderful. You know, I think this is a situation where being able to offer an epidural as a means of pain control for labor is absolutely fabulous. And we give women an option. There are some women who say, I don't want anything. And then they get into labor and say, oh, my gosh, this is more painful or longer than I anticipated. And there are others who walk in the door saying, I want my epidural now. I think this is clearly an area where we look at options and negotiate with a woman and sometimes her family. So it's a wonderful option that we've got available for women out there.
Emily, that sounds like Dr. Connery singing your tune, Give Women Options. What did you find in looking at the research, Emily?
Yeah, so I think that this is one of the things where it just because crystal clear to me that people are going to come to very different choices here. So I think, you know, there is like a huge upside to the epidural, which is that it is excellent pain relief in labor. Mm-hmm. There are some small downsides. So, you
like
know,
what?
In randomized trials, you see it increases the use of instruments in delivery. There's a, you know, an increased risk of an emergency C-section. There's slightly longer pushing time. There's a few sort of smaller things. I think the kind of broad picture is it slightly, and again, these are not huge effects, but it slightly increases the sort of complications of the process of labor. And I think that that's, you know, that some women will look at that like I did and say, you know what, like, I'm not going to have this. And many women, most of my friends have told me like, you're crazy. Do you know where the baby comes out of? The epidural is awesome. And, you know, and so I think really like those are both very reasonable choices. And I think that But I do think it's a place where when you see not so much from your obstetrician, but really on the sort of outside from the world, you do get very much these two camps of people saying like, you know, don't have the epidural. It's a terrible idea. And then on the other side, you know, oh, the epidural is totally without any downsides. And I think this is where kind of showing people the data helps you think through a little bit, you know, what's going to be right for me.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're testing the standard do's and don'ts for women in pregnancy in this hour. A little later in the hour, we're going to look at the moon mission. Heading off today to look at moon dust may be a big factor when it gets to colonization time up there. Emily Oster has written a new book about all the things you hear in pregnancy. It's called Expecting Better. She's an economist, and she's gone into the research herself to give her own take on what really makes sense, what may not. Read it and decide for yourself. Dr. Jean Conry is with us from Sacramento, California, president of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. We have so many callers here. Let's go straight to it. Kate in Newton, Massachusetts. Kate, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I saw Emily's article actually in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, and I loved it. I'm pregnant with my second child now. Mm-hmm. When I was pregnant with my first child in 2007, it was kind of a murky time for advice on antidepressant use, particularly Paxil. It's a Class D drug that I've been on for about 12 years. I have OCD and anxiety, and okay. I do cognitive behavioral therapy with it. And when I was pregnant with my first child, I kept getting no's, a couple of yeses here and there if I could stay on it or not. And I just, eventually I had to go back to the data. And I kept trying to dig up studies. There were a couple of studies where there might be a causal relationship. And in the end, I actually had to do what Emily suggests. And I had to trust my instincts that this could be worse off for me if I am not on this drug, especially after I have the child. I stayed on it, went against the grain. I'm happy I did. My postpartum depression was minimal. I had very few problems with OCD. 5 years later, I'm 34 weeks pregnant now, and almost every doctor that I have who's looked at my case history has told me to stay on it. So,
Kate, let us pick it up. Our time is short, but I'm so glad you raised it. Emily Oster says in the book, you know, there's no one answer to this. That is antidepressants, Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft, all that. Surely depends, she writes, on the severity of your illness before starting an antidepressant. Dr. Conry, what do you say on this one?
I think antidepressants, like many other the medications that we provide for women preconception or during pregnancy, have to be evaluated about need. And obviously, with this particular woman, there's a very important need there. So I think this is one where we clearly weigh risks and benefits. And the benefit is so strong, she should continue it. And I think that is the recommendation for any one of us. During pregnancy, it's about communication. We sit and evaluate a patient's needs and what the risks are and recommend what our best advice would be.
Let's run through some others that people have raised. Emily, sushi, cold cuts, so one of our callers raised, and you write about both. What about them, Emily?
Yeah, so what I write is basically, and you know, in the case of sushi, I think
what's the risk and what are you paying attention to there?
So the concern is with foodborne illness, so salmonella, mm-hmm. E. coli. And I think there, you know, you have a kind of similar – that risk exists when you're not pregnant. And so if you're having your sushi from a reputable source, there's kind of no particular reason to avoid it more during pregnancy, except for actually sort of having a stomach flu is like worse. To, like, if you're pregnant, it just feels yep. worse. But, you know, I think in the case of sushi, we do, you know, you do think you should avoid heavy, like high mercury fish, like tuna or mm-hmm. swordfish.
But you say pour on the sardines, those high omega-3,
yeah,
poor smart babies.
Absolutely. Sardines, okay. herring, like yeah. small oily fish are right. definitely a good right. idea. You know, in the case of cold cuts, I think that, you know, this is a sort of more complicated issue. The big concern is Listeria, which is a very, very dangerous bacteria. It's particularly dangerous for pregnant women. Of course, the thing people struggle with is actually it's very hard to predict sources of Listeria outbreaks. It's true that deli turkey is implicated on a slightly larger share, but other kinds of deli meats don't seem to have that kind of implication. And, you know, things like cantaloupe, celery are actually the source of many large outbreaks. So there's a sort of a little bit of a tricky issue that women have to think through about kind of how do I evaluate these risks relative to, you know, what the benefit would be of having a sandwich.
Dr. Conry, what do you say? Cold cuts, turkey, sushi.
So let's look at what we know. We know that Listeria is associated with miscarriages, stillbirths, preterm delivery, and very serious health problems in the newborn. It's a bacterial infection that is actually 20 times more common in pregnancy than in other healthy adults. And about one-third of all cases are found in pregnancy. Mm. So clearly we've got a situation where there's a risk. And what's the benefit? Avoiding deli meats or unpasteurized food, uncooked meats, uncooked food, washing your food. This is one where, as an obstetrician, I say to my patients, I can tell you the risks. Now, are there a lot of infections around the United States? No. So is any one individual at high likelihood of getting it? No. But if you're pregnant, you're 20 times more likely than your next-door neighbor to get an infection.
So you're basically saying give it a rest for those 9 months, I hear you say.
Give it a rest. I'll tell you, my honest observation of most pregnant women is, it was like Susan, they look at pregnancy and say, this is the healthiest I can be. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to have a good health outcome for me and for that baby.
No, I think that's certainly all the pregnant women think that. But I think when we think about something like listeria, we want to ask the question, of course, avoiding listeria is something that you want to do, definitely. But then you need to take the second step and ask the question, will engaging in this behavior have a large impact on my risk of listeria? And so I think that's what I encourage. That's sort of the framework that I go through in the book, is like, you want to think about, not only is listeria bad, which it is, but also, if I don't eat this thing, is that going to impact my risk of listeria very much? And I think that's where we want to look at, like, the source of recent outbreaks. And that's where you come to finding, you know, certain kinds of things like unpasteurized soft cheese, definitely a mistake. But some other things that maybe are typically on this list don't seem to actually be particularly heavily implicated. And so I think that's, you know, that's where the choice really comes
from. Emily, the economist, willing to wade in and make her own decision. Dr. Conry, looking at the whole country and saying, I don't know whether if that's going to work for everybody here. One more call. Cynthia, Springfield, Illinois. Cynthia, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you, Tom. I appreciate the conversation. And I think I have just a point to make, and is that Emily, the economist, is welcome to make her own decisions, as are all women. But for practitioners like myself and Dr. Conry, we're concerned with public health, and we're ultimately reliable for our patients' health and well-being. And there are a lot of litigious people out there who could come back and say, if we don't recommend this, you didn't tell us about this, and so we're ultimately liable. Well, Emily and her book are not liable for for these people and the patients.
Yeah, Emily's holding the flag for women to sort of wade in here, look at the data, and make some decisions for themselves. And I understand that on a personal level. I also get your public health perspective on this, Cynthia. Not everybody's going to do that. For anybody, right, that is not an easy thing. I mean, the amount of work Emily's done to go through all these categories, kind of overwhelming to a layperson. On the other hand, here it is laid out in a book. So listen, if you're pregnant and you want to read a lot of very thoughtful weighing of the extant research on different fronts, you may not always agree with Emily Oster. You may want to go back to your doctor. She says go back to your doctor for a final decision on this. But if you're wading into pregnancy and want some work that's been done on your behalf and looking at the research, this book definitely does that. Emily Oster, we got to go to the moon here for a second, but this has been really interesting. There are many more points. Listeners, if you're in this category of pregnant or headed there is a lot to learn between these covers and Emily Oster in New Haven today. I want to thank you very much for joining us to look at it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Expecting Better is the book. And Dr. Jean Conry, President of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, thanks for all of your insight on this today. Very good to have you with us, Dr. Conry.
Thank you, Tom, and I appreciate the other sources that are available. Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. If you're pregnant, good luck to you. A lot to learn right here. There's a link to the book at our website and an excerpt there, onpointradio.org. In a moment, we'll look at the NASA spacecraft that's leaving for the moon tonight. This is On Point. With countries and corporations clamoring to get to the moon, NASA is launching a spacecraft tonight that will capture the lunar atmosphere in its pristine state. The unmanned LADEE probe will take 30 days to look at moon dust, which scientists suspect is electrically charged, may levitate off the ground, and may be a big factor when and if Earthlings one day go for building colonies on the moon. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Emily Lakdawala, Senior Editor at the Planetary Society. Emily, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Moon dust as the major target here. Why is that interesting?
It's a fair question, to be sure. But yeah, the astronauts who went to the moon in the 60s and 70s found lunar dust to be a real problem. The stuff, as you said, levitates up off the surface. It gets absolutely everywhere. It electrostatically clings to everything. And as the sun sweeps around the moon every lunar day, which is about one Earth month, the dust that's right there at the sunset-sunrise line does very strange things electrostatically. So it's going to be cool to have this spacecraft, LADEE, check out where the dust is, what it's doing, and what it's made of.
And Emily, from what I've read here, this is not dust like we have on Earth. It's not smooth, not worn down by wind, because there isn't wind on the moon. It is sharp. It is jagged. It gets into skin and clothes. And maybe one day, if we get into the colonization business, or anybody does, machinery and, I don't know, the whole apparatus of being on the moon.
It's really terrible stuff. On Earth, most dust is actually biological in origin. On the moon, it's volcanic in origin. There was a lot of active volcanism on the moon way in the past, and this stuff was spewed into vacuum and crystallized as these little tiny microscopic shards of glass. There's also more dust that's been made by pulverizing the lunar surface for 4 billion years with impacts by meteorites, and it's this tiny, sharp, crystalline stuff. You can barely see it, but it, like I said, it gets everywhere. It gets into the joints and machines. It wears down bearings. It does nasty stuff, and we need to understand it better.
NASA always wants to learn for the sake of learning, but what about future plans around humans and the moon? How would understanding moon dust perhaps potentially come to bear in successful interaction with the moon?
Well, it does have important implications for how we engineer stuff to last for very long on the moon. And also, the lunar dust and the stuff that the lunar surface is made of is actually one day will probably become a construction material. We're not going to bring everything we need from Earth. We'll make it right there on the moon. So I think that it will be important to study it, but really the reason that we're doing it at this time is because the lunar environment is actually about to be disturbed a great deal by future landings, and this is our last chance, really, for a long time to see the moon in its pristine state.
People are talking about a big sort of a traffic jam of traffic headed for the moon. Like what? When? Who, Emily?
Well, the first one that's coming up this December is the Chinese are going to be sending a lunar lander and a rover very similar in size to the Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars, to do a soft landing on the moon. It'll be the first soft landing there in almost 40 years. And they're going to drive around with one rover. It's very likely they'll send another rover next year. And then after that, they plan to do a soft landing and sample return from the moon, which is going to be very exciting to see. But then there's also a lot of private companies and individuals getting into the Google Lunar X Prize and just kind of landing on the moon for the fun of it and the challenge of it. And I'm also greatly looking forward to see that. The moon is really relatively accessible. It's fairly close by. You can joystick machines from Earth on the moon instead of having to sequence them and build in a lot of robotic intelligence. And so I think that we're going to see a real explosion in private lunar exploration in the coming decade.
But first, coming right up, the Chinese, are we then going to see that Chinese flag flying on the moon the way years ago Americans took so much pride in the stars and stripes up there?
I can't imagine that we won't. I don't know if they'll bring a cloth flag with them, but I'm sure there will be a flag printed on their spacecraft.
What kind of, at this point, between national exploration, U.S., Chinese, you name it, others are interested as well, and commercial, what sort of interaction with the moon, beyond just a rover, let's say, is being contemplated if we look further out? Is it interesting as a place for actual habitation, for some kind of manufacturing, as a launching pad for further space travel? What, Emily?
Well, it's certainly interesting to explore for its own sake. I kind of view it a lot like Antarctica. You don't see a lot of people taking vacations in Antarctica. It's a really difficult place to survive. The science down there is absolutely fascinating. There's some really cool science that can be done from the moon. The moon itself is also very interesting to study because it's kind of like a time capsule. It's sort of frozen in time in the moment. After the Earth-Moon system formed, there was a lot of volcanism on the moon later, but there is a lot of stuff that has been preserved since the initial formation of the solar system, and it's just fascinating to study that. The moon has these incredibly deep basins gouged out by enormous impacts. they can see all the way down into the mantle of the moon. This is a layer of the Earth that we really can't see. The moon's got one, too, and we have these impacts that have dug it out and exposed it up at the surface, so people want to land inside some of these very deep basins. It's just going to be an incredibly cool place to explore.
So the X Prize for commercial access to the moon, is it just to gain experience in launching and traveling in space, or is there a moon-focused agenda there?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that the moon is certainly the most accessible location for human exploration, and I think it's conceivable that you could see, you could see vacationers traveling to the moon at some point. It has to be very wealthy ones. But it's a conceivable destination. I think that there are people who argue both sides about whether it's a useful stepping stone deeper into the solar system. There are others who argue that the moon's just another gravity well. Once you land there, you've got to get back off of it again. So it's better to explore things that have much less gravity, like asteroids, for instance. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Right now, the federal government is just not allotting enough money to do any of those things, and that's something that the Planetary Society is campaigning for to get the funds necessary to plan a real path into future human exploration of space.
And what about the LADEE, the spacecraft headed up there tonight? It's about the size of a Prius. It'll have a 100-day mission. What's it going to do? Just gulp the atmosphere? How close will it come to the surface? How much is it going to scoop up before it does its analysis?
It will. It has it's a spacecraft that actually will be flying through the lunar atmosphere. Now, of course, the lunar atmosphere is incredibly thin. It's so thin that the molecules in it never bump into each other. That makes it called an exosphere. Yeah, that's how thin it is. And there are many other places in the solar system. In fact, most other atmospheres are these surface boundary exospheres. Mercury has one. Many asteroids have them. Many moons in the outer solar system have them. Many Kuiper Belt objects do, although not Pluto. Pluto actually has a real atmosphere.
Is he going to bring this back home or just send home the data, Emily?
We just send home the data. So the spacecraft will be flying through the atmosphere with a mass spectrometer that can detect the size of the atoms and molecules that are in the atmosphere and tell us what they are. It also has a dust experiment that will scoop up dust and measure how big the dust particles are and how many there are by the impacts that they make on the dust counter. And it will be sending all of that data back.
Take off tonight of LADEE on its way to the moon's exosphere. Emily Lakdawala is with us from the Planetary Society. Emily, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome. This has been fun.
This is On Point.